poor C.S. Lewis, the ancient pagan myths had truth value. He believed God was using them to prepare people for the coming of the gospel.
I'm Dr. Sarah Waters, and this is All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. All About Jack is celebrating its 10th anniversary in 2021. Today is the third of a series of six episodes spotlighting the Thorns bookshelf, C.S. Lewis on Why Myth Matters. The author, Dr. Charlie Starr, is back helping to explore it. And I'm co-hosting this special short series with William O'Flaherty, the creator and producer of All About Jack. So, take it away.
Thank you, Sarah. Well, now, in the last episode, we went deeper into the first part of the book entitled Folios and Fawns. There's a link in the show notes to it, as well as a link to the debut episode. Today, we go into more detail into the second part of the Fawns bookshelf, which also has three chapters like the previous section. This part is called Narnian Reality, Terran Myth. Before having Sarah pitch the first question, welcome back to All About Jack, Charlie.
Thank you, William. Always fun to be here with Sir William Castor of Pods, writer about Screwtape, and keeper of the gate of actual versus fake Lewis quotes. Glad to be with you, William. And I'm also glad to be here with Lady Sarah, scholar of Lewis and Shakespeare, doing wonderful things across the pond in Lewis studies.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you very much. So we're going to start with the fourth chapter, which kicks off part two of your book. And this is called The Life and Letters of Silenus. I was just wondering, why do you think Lewis focuses on Silenus when he's actually sort of a sidekick to Bacchus? And why would Lewis use either?
Right. So one of the books in on Tumnus's bookshelf is The Life and Letters of Silenus. Why would he choose to focus on Silenus at all? And why Silenus instead of Bacchus, who is really the main character in terms of the myth between the two? Bacchus is more important than Silenus is. Let's start by reminding the audience that Silenus is somebody they might have actually seen portrayed in film once. And that is, so now audience, you're going to have to go way back into your Disney vault and find the movie Fantasia. And in one of the sequences that's closer to the end of the film, I think, there's this sequence involving lots of Greek mythology. And you'll see one scene where there's this drunken little rotund man sitting on a donkey wearing a toga. And that drunken little rotund man is Silenus. And he has come for the party. So, hey, you know, there's a connection there for a mythological character you might otherwise never have heard of. So why Silenus over Bacchus? Here's some speculation. One is, depending on the version of the story, sometimes Silenus is a satyr who is actually incredibly intelligent and was the teacher, the instructor for Bacchus. And so he would have been one who actually had letters that he wrote. Bacchus is too busy being a party god. So Silenus would have maybe been the intellectual of the two who would have actually written some letters down. That could be one reason. If he is a satyr, and he's not a satyr in every version of his story, but if he's a satyr, that's in the same family as Fawns. And so Tumnus might have been more interested in reading about a relative by species than reading about Bacchus. So that's a potential option there. Something else I thought of only as I was preparing for this talk, so it's actually not in the book, is I wonder if we could look at Silenus as a kind of John the Baptist to Bacchus's Christ. And we'll talk more about that when we look at comparisons between Bacchus and Christ here in just a second. But that was an interesting idea to me. The one thing that we do know about Silenus in the Narnian world, according to the text, is that he was around more than Bacchus was. So, and of course, this was before the 100 years of winter under the White Witch. But Silenus used to show up to spring parties and that would, I guess, would be a drunken little rotund Silenus, more than smart, sadder Silenus. And Bacchus would show up occasionally. So maybe Silenus was part of the Narnian world a little bit more. And again, that would have been a reason for him to be more interesting to Mr. Tumnus. But then that can take us to the question, well, why either one of them at all? Why would these sort of pagan characters, one of them a pagan god, be something that Lewis would include in his book to children when Lewis is writing so much about a Christian worldview in his book, or coming from that particular worldview in his book? Well, one of the things that Lewis talked about in regard to myth is that myth, in his mind, acted as a kind of preparatio evangelica, which is to say that for C.S. Lewis, the ancient pagan myths had truth value in that he believed God was using them to prepare people for the coming of the gospel. And so there are numerous stories in various mythologies around the world of a God who dies and is born again. And Lewis believed God put those stories in among those myths in order to let people recognize the true God when he finally did arrive, or when his story finally did arrive. So here are these pagans, and they have their false gods and their false myths. But in Lewis's mind, they're not 100% false. And in Lewis's mind, while God spoke to the Jewish people directly through word, through law, and in historical interaction with them, God was speaking to the pagans through their poets, in their poets' imaginations. So the poets might not know about the existence of the one true God, but God was still working among them, even in their obscure belief systems, to get some elements of the truth in, and that would prepare for the coming of the one myth, as Lewis would say, the one myth that was also a fact. All right, so the idea then that when the Norse people learn about Christ who died and was raised from the dead, they might make the connection then to Balder the Beautiful, who was most beloved among the gods, but was betrayed and died, and yet was brought back to life. And so then there might have been that wonderful appeal, and that would have helped them see the truth of Christianity. The larger connection is probably between Bacchus and Christ, and that is this idea that although I call Bacchus a party god, he was in fact a fertility god. He was a god of wine and revelry, and he was a god to be taken seriously. While he was the god of parties, he was also a very dangerous god, and you didn't want to get on his bad side. So one of the famous Greek plays, a play called the Bacchae, then, is about how the women of the local city, I think it's set in Athens, the women of the local city are taken out into the fields and the forests to worship in the wild Bacchanalia, the feast of Bacchus, but the men refuse to do so. And the king Pentheus, in his refusal, ends up getting destroyed. In fact, he gets torn apart and eaten. And part of the great wild Bacchanalian feast is that the animal sacrifice is an animal who becomes the god. The animal is destroyed, dismembered, and eaten. A really interesting parallel there to the myth of Osiris from Egyptian mythology, that dismemberment. But then as a god of wine and as a god who gets eaten, Bacchus is a symbol for Christ. And this is something that Lewis points out. I want to say it's in Miracles. I have it recorded in the book, and shame on me for not knowing my own book better. But if it's not in Miracles, it's in Mere Christianity. At any rate, Lewis points to that moment where Jesus accomplishes his first miracle. And the first miracle is the turning of water into wine at a wedding feast. So here we have a feast. It's a party, like in the story of Bacchus or his Greek name Dionysus. And there is wine, and wine flows. In Narnia, whenever Bacchus would visit, the rivers would flow with wine instead of water. Wine, of course, is a strong Christian symbol, symbolizing fertility and joy and pleasure and celebration, but then also blood and sacrifice. And that fits the idea of Bacchus very well. He is this god of revelry, but he's also a very dangerous god, a god of sacrifice. And Bacchus then is the god who dies. And in some of the versions of the story, he dies and is born again. So some of the earlier versions of the Dionysus story have him being dismembered by the Titans and consumed except for his heart. His heart then is swallowed by Zeus, and Zeus impregnates his mother Semele, and he is reborn. So Dionysus, in addition to being a god connected to wine and sacrifice, is a resurrection god. And he is connected to Christ then by wine and by resurrection and by the Eucharist, by communion, where the body and the blood are taken in by the feasters. So what this meant for Lewis was that in Christ, we see the disguise comes off. What the Greeks understood as this god Dionysus or the Roman Bacchus was simply a type of the true god of wine, the true god of sacrifice, the true god of resurrection, the true god of the Eucharist, and that was Christ. Now, some Christians may have difficulty in accepting the idea that we can talk about parallel religions, that the stories we find in this pagan religion are similar to the story of Christ. And Christians will say, well, that's just an attempt to hurt Christianity, to take away its credibility. In fact, many atheists have used this very argument, that there are many similarities between the story of Christ and the story of other gods like Osiris and Dionysus and Balder and so forth. And so to the atheists, then, this is just one more invented religion. C.S. Lewis says, no, the contrary. It's absolutely the contrary is true. He specifically says, if there had not been other myths of the dying and reviving God, he might have never become a Christian. But it was clear to him that the religions of the world aren't utter and complete lies. They carry some truth, and it's the truth that God placed in them so that people could recognize when the truest truth, the one true religion, did finally come along, when the one God was no longer merely a myth, but he was a fact. One last connection then between Bacchus and Christ is a connection of glory. Glory is a very interesting concept for Lewis. He wrote an entire sermon on it, The Weight of Glory. And he said to face the glory of God could kill you, among other things, but then to desire the glory of God is central to Christian thinking. We want to see his glory. We want to be enveloped in his glory. But, you know, Lewis will point out that when we go back to Moses, so Moses said to God, I think in Exodus, let me see your glory. God said, if you saw my face, it would kill you. Lewis points out then that God does present myth to us, myth that became fact, and he presented myth to the Jews so that they could be prepared for the coming of the true myth, and so that they could stand his glory. All right, so the people could not look upon God, so he hid in the cloud on the mountain. Moses came down from the mountain, and Moses is shining with the glory of God, so he's too frightening to the people. He has to start wearing a veil, right? But in Pilgrim's Regress, then C.S. Lewis will say, this is myth that I'm presenting to you, to his character John, but it's my myth. It's the way I choose to show myself to you. And then he says, don't you remember the story of Semele? And then in various versions of the story, Semele is the mother of Dionysus, right? And the version of the story goes that when Semele was impregnated by Zeus, Zeus's wife Hera found out about it, and she tricked Semele into telling Zeus to make a promise to her that he wouldn't break. And he said, okay. And Hera told Semele, have him show you himself in all of his glory. And when that happens, Semele is absolutely baked, literally. You know, she's just burned by the fire of God's glory. And then the Dionysian essence must survive. I think in that particular version, rather than swallowing the heart, what's left is put inside the thigh of Zeus. So again, there are various versions of the story, but Bacchus then is a glory god. He is the product of when divine glory encounters humanity, and humanity may be overwhelmed by it, or humanity may be saved by it. So we think of Philippians chapter 2, where it says that Christ emptied himself of his glory. He took on the form of a human being so that we could see him face to face, so that we can meet God face to face and not be absolutely destroyed by it. Otherwise, the one promise we have sort of in the book of Revelation, I think in the very last chapter, is we will get to see the face of God someday. And that will be in a heavenly world when we have been filled with his glory so that it doesn't burn us alive, so that it doesn't absolutely destroy us. But for all these reasons, then, I think Lewis would have mentioned Bacchus and Silenus.
Thank you for that, Charlie. In fact, I think some of what you were saying, it goes beyond and expounds on some of the things in your book. But of course, we want to encourage people to get the book and they get the essential elements of what you were just sharing, as well as the other information that we're touching on here. In fact, this very chapter, the fourth chapter, I noticed that you highlight some other sources from Lewis's work that you note in your book, underscores the fact that pleasure doesn't have to be an enemy of God. So can you tell us about some of those?
Well, sure. I think one of the sources is the Weight of Glory sermon that we mentioned, how it draws us to God far more than fear of punishment is a desire for something absolutely amazing. And that is that desire to be filled with his glory or to be filled with his beauty. Another really important source is letters to Malcolm. One of the beautiful moments in those letters is when Lewis is talking about the play and he's talking about pleasure. And these things are things that on earth can't quite be taken seriously, but in heaven they become the most serious thing there is. And he even concludes that letter by saying, pleasure is the serious business of heaven. But probably the finest source that anybody can turn to for understanding Lewis's idea that God wants us to experience pleasure is actually the Screwtape letters. Specifically, I invite the audience to look at letter 22, which in my mind is the funniest of the letters, because that's the letter at the end of which Screwtape turns into a giant centipede. And I would also suggest that the audience would get a kick out of listening to John Cleese read letter 22, and you can find that on YouTube for free. So letter 22 is just absolutely delightful. And in that, Screwtape talks about how God is a hedonist at heart, and he wants people to have all kinds of pleasures. There's all kinds of things people are allowed to do, sleeping, eating, taking walks, reading books. And Screwtape, complains about that because all the demons can do is pervert pleasures. And throughout the Screwtape letters, and Screwtape will tell Wormwood, you want to keep people away from good pleasures. You can pervert them, you can turn them toward bad pleasures, but you want to keep them away from good pleasures because good pleasures can be very dangerous. So don't allow your patient to read a good book. Get him just to read a magazine article or a newspaper clipping or something like that. So, and then Screwtape reminds Wormwood of one of his own patients who, upon arriving in hell, realized that throughout his life, he had not done what he should have done, but he also hadn't done what he wanted to do. And so you think about those times in your life when you've got some free time and there's some fun thing that you enjoy doing. Maybe it's doing research or reading in C.S. Lewis. And you have to actually fight to make yourself do this thing. That ever happened to you where you just got to force yourself to do a thing that you otherwise didn't feel like doing? You love to do. And so I'm convinced that's a Screwtapian ploy. Charlie, just sit and watch TV. That's so much easier than working on a new Lewis project or reading through Narnia again or something like that. And so, yeah, I think Screwtape especially is a good resource for seeing how God wants us to pursue right pleasures.
That's great. Thank you very much. So turning to chapter 5 now, which is entitled Fauns are from Mars, Nymphs are from Venus. I think you talked really helpfully in this chapter about gender and Lewis on gender, which kind of speaks to stuff that's circulating in our contemporary world today, as well as things circulating in his world. I was wondering if you could maybe unpack a little bit of that for our listeners.
Yeah, the unusual thing about fauns is that they're all male. There are no faunettes. And fauns are most attracted to nymphs, and nymphs are all female. There are no man-nymphs, all right? They're just nymphs, okay? And that got me thinking about Lewis and gender, and he does have a lot to say about it. Now, you're not going to find a C.S. Lewis who was a feminist. You're not particularly going to find a C.S. Lewis who hated women either. Some of his dearest friends and some of his most intellectual discussions were with women. And the wife that he married, and a lot of people think Lewis never married, but the wife that he married was every bit able to keep up with him on an intellectual level. And she was herself a poet and a writer. So Lewis had great relationships with women, but he also believed, and not in any stereotypical fashion, that there are differences between men and women, and that these differences are both biological and spiritual. And so this is a key idea for Lewis, is that gender is not merely a matter of biological sex, but it represents a kind of spiritual dichotomy in terms of one of the ways God communicates himself into the world. And so we go back to Genesis, where it says God created man in his own image. He created them, plural in the Hebrew, male and female. So something in God's nature is both masculine and feminine. And when he created us, he created us in his image to bear out those two genders. Lewis likes to play with this a great deal. He even proposes at least the possibility of more than two genders on some spiritual level in his book, That Hideous Strength. What exactly he means by that is quite a mystery to us. In fact, he says in the book that it's only these two genders that we can understand because we have our own biological parallel. But in Perelandra, then, when we meet two of the Oiarses, two of the archangels or ruling angels, one, though it is not male in biologically, is clearly masculine in gender, and the other is feminine in gender. So again, there's this idea that for Lewis, gender is a spiritual quality, not merely a biological quality. At the same time, for Lewis, I think things get really complicated, which I think it's complicated in a very good way. It is to say that, well, let me put it in these terms. When we look at fauns, when we look at these masculine characters, what they seem to symbolize in my mind, and I think for Lewis, is that human beings are dual creatures. We are amphibians, if you will. We are both animal and spiritual. And we are unique, according to Lewis, in all of God's creation for that reason. We can live forever, and yet we have to go to the bathroom. And for C.S. Lewis, the very fact that we laugh at bathroom humor is proof of our recognition that we are both animal and spiritual. And the fauns represent the coming together of these two elements, of the physical self and the spiritual self. So a faun is half man, half goat, half man, half animal. And for Lewis, that's a masculine representation for some reason. Well, nymphs then are tree spirits. If you take the spirit out of a tree, the thing that's walking around and talking and dancing with fauns is a nymph. So the nymph is, if you will, a kind of a feminine recognition for Lewis that we are also more than just physical, that somehow the spiritual matters more. Now, why Lewis would say, would make the one masculine and the other feminine, or again, is he just following mythology? I don't know. But what's really interesting to me is that each of these types, one masculine, one feminine, comments on the spiritual duality of human beings in two different ways. One saying that we're utterly wed, one saying, and yet there is something so very different between the spirit self and the physical self. It's not an absolute difference, because when a tree is cut down in Narnia in the last battle, its tree spirit dies. So that's, you know, very significant. But nevertheless, nymphs and fauns as the two creatures, masculine and feminine, who want very much to be wed with each other, are so very different. Now, one of the things that can result from this idea that Lewis believed gender is a quality of spirit would be an approach that some modern folks have taken in saying that gender then is utterly fluid, and that if it is spiritual, then gender cannot be tied to anything biological. Now, I realize that there are some approaches that simply say gender is entirely culturally created. But if we set those aside, we just take the issue that even some Christian believers will say gender is fluid because gender is a completely spiritual quality. I think one of the things that fauns and nymphs teach us is something that Lewis believed, and that is of the importance of incarnation. All right. Lewis said that the incarnation was a grander miracle. In fact, he called it the grand miracle, than even the death and resurrection of Christ. Incarnation, he said, transcends myth. It's myth plus. It's myth made super. And he said that in incarnation, we see the missing piece that makes all of human history and human creation and the creation that we live in make sense in Lewis's mind. That is this idea of incarnation. So I think for Lewis, there's a sacramental quality to gender symbolized in the differences, if you will, between fauns and nymphs. And that is while... And Lewis will even say that sometimes men and women in a marriage will swap the gender roles, and there is some fluidity to be had there. Lewis will also say, I think, that masculine bodies are paired with masculine souls, and feminine bodies are paired with feminine souls. And so women have feminine souls, though because gender is spiritual, they can be in touch with a masculine side, to use that sort of phrase, or men can be in touch with a feminine side. So Lewis would say it's a little bit of both. They're joined together, if you will, like the fawn, and sort of stuck with each other. And they're also not quite the same as each other as in the way the nymph is represented, the nymph who is part of her tree and yet separate from her tree. So incarnation is a key idea for Lewis, and the most important myth in his mind, then the myth that became fact, the highest myth to ever come down to earth, is the myth of the incarnation of Christ. So, ultimately Lewis's thoughts on gender lead to his, thoughts on myth. And ultimately then that's why I wanted to connect those ideas together in the Fawn's Bookshelf.
Now, related to that, you summarized Lewis's views on hierarchy and equality, and they're quite insightful. Tell us about them and how they might help us better understand the way this influenced Narnia. And then, you know, parallel to that, how his views are often misunderstood.
So for C.S. Lewis, who wrote an essay entitled Equality, equality is not the end-all and be-all of any human civilization, because the creation itself is not a creation based on equality. And now that is shocking to us, and that's especially shocking to Americans who live for equality. We live for freedom and equality. And I know in the West in general that virtue is a significant one for other nations. For C.S. Lewis, equality is necessary because people are broken. And so as much as we can spread the power as possible so that people can't manipulate and use each other, that's why we need equality. But in Lewis's mind, equality is like medicine. Medicine is something you need to cure something. Once you have the cure, you don't need the medicine anymore. And so when Lewis pictures heaven, he pictures what the Bible pictures, which is a kingdom. It is hierarchical. There are those who are in charge, those who are more in charge, and there is God sitting on a throne, and he is the great king, or in Narnia, the emperor over the sea. And Aslan, as gentle and wonderful and lovely as he is also dangerous and frightening to look at, and certainly not a tame lion. I can remember a time visiting a zoo, probably the last time I visited a zoo. I walked around a corner and I just happened to walk right up to the bear display. Display is the wrong word. The bear exhibit. Anyway, there was this big giant grizzly bear in a cage. And I walked the corner and there he was 6 feet away from me. And I was afraid because you see them on television. Okay. But you really see the power of these things when you meet them up close. You know, his claw was the size of my face. And if he had batted at my head, he could have taken it off the shoulders. So when you see that kind of power and that strength, you learn something of humility and awe. And while Lewis thought equality was good medicine, he thought it was not our end. Our end is to live in a hierarchy. So that's the first thing. Second thing, when we make equality a goal in and of itself, culturally, it leads to a demand for equality, which results in a kind of mediocrity, which is to say, if we teach all of our students in school, for example, that they're all wonderful, that they're all great people, that they're all equal, and that everything is awesome, what we end up doing is raising generations of students who are happy to be average, who are happy to be C students, who are happy to be mediocre. And of course, if somebody rises higher, if somebody is incredibly successful at business and becomes wealthy, they are automatically evil simply because they are rich. Or if somebody is a celebrity, we love our celebrities and yet we tear them down. We like to point out all of their flaws and mistakes. If somebody is extra smart, we're going to give them wonderful epithets like nerd and geek and dweeb and Waldo, although some of those are actually becoming more popular. You know, nerd is the new cool. But it kind of raises a culture where everybody doesn't just believe that everybody's equal. They demand that everybody be equal. And what I think of is a short story by Kurt Vonnegut called Harrison Bergeron, in which hundreds of amendments have been passed to the U.S. Constitution, all of which then force people to be equal. So in this case, strong people are required to carry extra weights. Beautiful people are required to wear ugly masks. All the newscasters are people with lisps and speech impediments. Musicians who are incredibly talented must wear all kinds of weights and cables that keep them from being able to play their instruments well, things like that. So a demand for equality is a real danger. Thirdly, then, Lewis would point out that equality starves our desire for hierarchy. That is to say, while while I, as a good American, would say it's all about equality. Nevertheless, all of us who are constantly shouting about the importance of equality have our film stars, our music stars, our celebrities, our people that we think are awesome, people that we turn into our little gods, our little idols. our little kings and queens. You take away the monarchy, you'll simply, and Lewis very specifically said this, you take away the monarchy, you'll just replace the monarch with film stars and music stars, or don't forget sports celebrities then too, sports stars. And it may be good that they're worthy of our praise, but that's Lewis's point, is we ought to have people like that to praise. We ought to think hierarchically in terms of a number of things. And if we starve ourselves of the desire for hierarchy, we will simply replace it with a bad hierarchy in his mind. So that's the danger of hierarchy. And you can certainly see that in the way that he builds the Ransom trilogy, where there are, there is Maladil, the old and the young, and then there's the Oyarses, the ruling angels, and then there's the Eldils, the other kinds of angels, and so on. There's a definite hierarchy there. And then in Narnia, you see it with the demand for kings and queens, with the fact that the kings and queens of Narnias come from the human race and they rule over the animals, things like that.
Now, back in the first show, you talked a little bit about, or you gave us a kind of preview, I guess, of two things that matter to Lewis, which you take up in your sixth chapter. So could you remind us what they are and tell us a little bit about how they're relevant today?
Yeah, in chapter six, we take up the question, so why the Sylvan myths? What Bacchus and Silenus and Tumnus and nymphs all have in common is that they're Sylvan myths. That is, they are connected to nature. Nature apart from human creation, nature apart from industry, from technology, from the city, but God's creation. And they are important for Lewis because he loved nature. And there were two things then that bothered him very specifically. One is that progress that kills nature is abominable. All right. So we can make progress, we can build buildings, we can create roads, but if we overextend ourselves, if we do too much of this, if we turn all of the British Isles into one vast parking lot, we're going to rue the day. And of course, that can be applied all over the world, that the stripping of the land is a terrible thing. And Lewis was frequently unhappy with the kind of work that was being done, even in Oxford, to just destroy a lot of nature for the sake of so-called progress. Lewis he called himself anti-progress in that sense. And it's not that he is anti-science or anti-technology. It's that he is anti-science and technology for the sheer sake of power that just absolutely destroys nature. So he just doesn't want people to take it too far. He was an early tree hugger in the best possible sense. The other thing that Lewis rejected and that the Sylvans help him reject symbolically is a mechanistic view of nature, where we see nature as only a machine. One of my favorite lines in Voyage of the Dawn Treader is when kids from Earth find out that stars in Narnia are alive. And then Eustace says, well, in our world, stars are just big balls of gas. To that, I believe it's Aslan who replies, even in your world, that's only what they're made of. So a mechanistic approach to nature reduces nature to merely its physical material, its atoms. It reduces human beings to mere animals, animals to mere chemical processes. And in so doing, well, it gives us an excuse then to abuse nature, going back to the first point. But more than that, as the first point involves stripping land, this point involves stripping meaning. It is about the stripping of meaning from the world, so that nothing matters anymore, nothing is significant anymore, nothing means anything anymore. And I think there was a very powerful moment in the 20th century when man had adopted this so heavily that the world was becoming ugly, physically ugly, and no one could find meaning in a sunset, meaning in flowers. These were simply impractical things that had no real real meaning in life. And in stripping of nature of meaning through this mechanistic view, then we strip it of its beauty. And beauty is incredibly therapeutic for the human soul. And uglifying, if you will, to go with the duffelpuds, uglifying the world, I think, is something Screwtape wants us to do, so that we can't, so that beauty can't call us, glory can't call us to something greater.
Okay, and then again, that was from chapter 6 that you were just touching on, which is entitled Why Sylvan Myths Matter. And so this has been part 2 from Charlie's book, this third episode on the Fonz Bookshelf, looking at Narnian reality, Terran myth. So with that, we're going to conclude this third of a 6-part mini-series on the Fonz Bookshelf by Dr. Charlie Starr. But before we do that, let me have Sarah share a little bit about herself. She's been doing an excellent job with co-hosting duties and helping me in creating the questions.
Thank you very much. That's been a pleasure. So I work on Lewis, and I'm particularly interested in Lewis's work and reading and interactions with Shakespeare, particularly Shakespeare in drama, actually. So for example, this week I was looking at Lewis as a reader through his annotations on his Shakespeare plays, which is great fun. These are not published material, which makes it perhaps even more exciting. But just looking at the way he interacted with the texts and how we see that feeding into his writing as well. So obviously we see it in his academic criticism, but I think we also see it coming through in his fiction as well. And that's quite exciting. So yeah, that's what I'm working on at the moment. So I published some of my work on Lewis and Shakespeare, particularly on his science fiction series, the trilogy that Charlie was talking a little about earlier. So particularly it looks, the article looks at Out of the Silent Planet and Paralandra and their connections to both Shakespeare, more specifically The Tempest. And that was published in the journal called Foundation in 2020. And I'm working on a couple of book length projects as well connected to that research. And when I'm not working on Lewis and Shakespeare, I'm a lecturer in English literature at the University of Buckingham, where I'm also an honorary junior research fellow.
Well, thank you, Sarah, and we look forward to see many future things, as well as we encourage people to look up things that they might be of interest. And then if you're listening to this before March 2022, scheduled in that time is for Sarah to be one of the many speakers at a special event in Montreat, North Carolina, that's entitled From Shakespeare to the Inklings, The Bible's Impact on Creative Imagination, and there'll be a link in the show notes regarding that. Then wrapping up finally here, then if you haven't heard the previous shows, then check the show notes for direct links to them. Well, before we go, thank you, Charlie, for joining Sarah and I today.
Thanks, William. This was a lot of fun.
And then finally, thank you again, Sarah, for your co-hosting.
Thank you very much.
Thanks also to you who are listening to this episode of All About Jack. All About Jack is a feature of the website EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, I'm the creator of the show, William O'Flaherty. Be sure to visit EssentialCSLewis.com, where you will find a variety of content. That includes, of course, previous episodes of All About Jack. But another popular part of the site is a series of articles about quotations credited to Lewis that he might not have written. I also have a YouTube channel called Knowing and Understanding C.S. Lewis. There's a link in the show notes to it. Today you heard the third episode in a series of 6 programs from a mini-series about the Fonz Bookshelf. Episode 4 will provide an overview of the second half of Charlie's book, while the final 2 shows will go deeper into the third and fourth part of the Fonz Bookshelf. You'll find links in the show notes to purchase the book, along with links to other places that were mentioned during the show. I'll also provide links to episodes where Charlie was a guest. Speaking of those notes, you can find them at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show. But it might be just as easy to find them where the podcast is hosted, which is allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. You can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes, see the show notes for a direct link to it there, and consider rating my show on iTunes to help others find it. And of course, please consider sharing this show so others can hear it. Before closing out, in case you didn't know, I've written two books related to C.S. Lewis. Buying them is a great way to indirectly support this podcast, so it can continue to be made freely available. In 2018, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis was published. It explores 75 quotations credited to Lewis. Most are not by him, some are paraphrases, and a few are ones that could be misunderstood without more context. Then in 2016, my first book was released. It's an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters, humorously called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. Learn more about it and get a free PDF sample by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Finally, thank you again for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty. Thank you.